You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved.
Many stones can form an arch, singly done. And by union, what we will can be.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Boyd, Kenter, Thomas & Parrish, LLC, and Service Employees International Union, Local 1. Since 1983, our attorneys have aggressively represented the injured and have provided counseling to labor organizations throughout the area. We stand up for working families against those who would harm. And Service Employees International Union, Local 1, gives workers and working families a voice in fighting for respect and dignity on the job. Our members are janitors in Kansas City and surrounding suburbs and local sports entertainment staff. And we thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, are we developing a global working class? We'll talk to Emmanuel Ness about his new book, Southern Insurgency. Then, Chiluba Musanda came to Kansas City from Zambia as a student. He will tell his story about what it takes to make it in this Midwestern city as an international student and what it means to have a home away from home. In the news, right-winger is already talking about another round next year of Right to Work. And bombshell report that 40% of women in the fast food industry face sexual harassment on the job. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Ario. She'll talk about lead exposure beyond Flint and ask, does Dollar General ignore safety inspections? Now for the news. This is the news from our side. Missouri lawmaker Representative Holly Rader, Republican from Sikeston, plans to file right-to-work legislation in January. She said that if Attorney General Chris Coster, a Democrat, wins the governor's race, she will try to bypass a sure veto by Coster and have the measure placed on the statewide ballot, even though a statewide ballot on right to work failed in 1978 when 60% of Missourians rejected it. Missouri Net reports that Rader says things are different now. She says, you know, it's been back in the 70s when it failed at the ballot box. However, union membership was about 30%, where now it's less than 8. The deceptively named Right to Work says that a person cannot be required to join or refrain from joining a labor organization as a condition of employment. Rader, who chairs the House Select Committee on Labor and Industrial Relations, says states that have passed Right to Work have seen increased employment, including more union jobs. But Coster and other Democrats disagree. Coster says he would veto Right to Work, saying states that have passed it have lower wages, fewer benefits, and more dangerous workplaces. He says public service should aim to move the rights of people forward, not backward, to a time without even a minimum wage. Coster wrote in the Missouri Times, op-ed, that statement. Coster also says Right to Work states on average saw smaller median income growth than Missouri. Coster faces Eric Greitens, a Republican, in November. Greitens supports Right to Work. Rader is unopposed in November. She'll begin her third House term in January.
In coordinated press conferences around the nation today, Fight for 15 and a union workers filed 15 federal complaints with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or the EEOC, against McDonald's in multiple locations around the country, alleging incidents of sexual harassment. The workers released a survey by Heart Research Associations and Futures Without Violence, the MS Foundation for Women, and the National Partnership for Women and Families. The survey found that 40% of women in the fast food industry report facing sexual harassment on the job. Previous survey research suggests this rate is substantially higher than in workplaces overall. Women who experience sexual harassment feel forced to accept it because they can't afford to lose their job. More than one in five women who face sexual harassment report that, after raising the issue, their employer took some negative action, including cutting their hours, changing them to a less desirable schedule, giving them additional duties, and being denied a raise. The most common forms of sexual harassment experienced by women in the fast food industry include sexual teasing, jokes, remarks, or questions, hugging or touching, and questions about sexual interests or unwanted information about other sexual interests, according to the survey. The complaints outline graphic instances of alleged sexual assault. One complaint by Jasmine Bell from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, says that on multiple occasions, Bell's manager would lean over her while she was bending over so his genitals were pressed against her or in her face when she looked up, and that he would also make lewd comments towards her. Cortez Clerk in Flint, Michigan, alleges that her shift manager would regularly rub his genitals against Clerk's butt or try to grab her butt, and that on July 17th, he showed her a picture of his genitals on his phone. And in Phoenix, Arizona, Consuelo Leon says that she and two other employees were verbally and physically sexually harassed by their manager, who cornered Consuelo Leon when she was working the drive-thru. He caressed her back and then unsnapped her bra. African-American workers, 33%, and Latinas, 32%, are more likely to face these types of work disruptions than are white women, 25%. Casey Wagner of the Worker Institute at Cornell University ILR School said, "Having less power on the job does not mean these women have any less workplace rights to safety, dignity, racial justice, and economic security while on the job." The survey was based on interviews with a national sample of 1,271 women aged 16 and older who work in a fast food restaurant and non-managerial positions. Interviews were conducted online from July 22nd to July 27th, 2016. When asked about the filings, Terry Hickey, a spokesperson for McDonald's, said in a statement, "At McDonald's, we and our independent owner-operators share a deep commitment to the respectful treatment of everyone. There is no place for harassment and discrimination of any kind in McDonald's restaurants or in any workplace. We take any concerns seriously, and we are reviewing the allegations."
75 people, led by Missouri Jobs with Justice, rallied today in Jefferson City as the state Supreme Court took up cases from Kansas City and St. Louis challenging the state legislatures blocking the two cities from raising their minimum wage. Last year, the Southern Christian Leadership Council got petitions signed to put a $15 minimum wage proposal on the Kansas City Leadership Council. But after the state legislature passed a preemption bill, a judge ordered that the vote be canceled. The St. Louis case was brought after the St. Louis Board of Aldermen voted to raise the local minimum wage to $11 an hour. They claimed the right to do so, since they passed it before August 28th, when the preemption bill took effect. A coalition of business groups challenged the ordinance. The protesters came from Kansas City and St. Louis. They stopped by the office at the Hotel and Lodging Association for a quick demo, protesting the industry's attempt to keep its workers from earning a living wage. Then, after a spirited rally at the Supreme Court, they delivered a giant blow-up letter to the offices of the Missouri Republican Party, very sarcastically thanking them for keeping our workers poor and doing the bidding of the American Legislative Exchange Council, which had been shopping a model bill to state legislatures titled the Living Wage Preemption Act. Today's news was read by Judy Ansel, Jan Zaman, and myself, Shaikolyn Hams.
South of the border, in the loving tongue, they used to sing corridos by the Rio Grande. And every singer told of his adventures bold, back in the times when Pancho Villa and Zapata rolled south of the border. How the times have changed. Maquiladora plants along the Rio Grande, and the song they sing is just a money thing that will leave you in the morning without anything. Your lover is a gringo from a northern land. He will promise you like he promised me. All he'll ever give you is a one-night stand. See how he's treated me. South of the border, like the peso shines, the flowers come to bloom beside the Rio Grande. They find a job that pays below the living wage. They'll wither in the sun before they come of age. South of the border, it's like Love Canal. Maquiladora plants pollute the Rio Grande, and their only care is for the profits there. You will soon be like their other lovers everywhere. By the Rio Grande, and every singer told of his adventures bold back in the times when Pancho Villa and Zapata rolled. Your lover is a gringo from a northern land. He will promise you like he promised me. All he'll ever give you is a one-night stand. See how he's treated me.
That was Ann Feeney with Larry Penn's Maquiladoras. I'm Judy Ansel. Over the last few decades, the world's seen an enormous restructuring of work, production, and commerce, and with them, a restructuring of the global working class. While pundits write books predicting the end of the working class and the end of the labor movement, tonight's guest, Emmanuel Ness, a professor of political science at the City University of New York, has a startlingly different perspective. In his new book, Southern Insurgency, The Coming of the Global Working Class, he argues that the working class hasn't disappeared, it's moved to the global south. And rather than being immobilized by the tyranny of global corporations, it's actually taking the first steps to come together as a class with surprising militancy and creativity in organization. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, Manny.
It's a pleasure. And to be on Heartland. Thank you very much, Judy.
And you're in Belgrade right now. What are you doing there?
I'm doing research around labor issues. There's that situation here.
Oh, great.
In terms of the economy, well, not great, but...
Okay, good. Well, first of all, I want to set the stage for this discussion. You say that the growth of a global working class follows on the heels of trade liberalization, that's like free trade agreements, neoliberal capitalism, and global imperialism beginning in the 1980s and continuing. Why is it important to understand that globalization is both neoliberal and imperialist?
That's a very good point. Well, first of all, it's neoliberal because... the nature of capital has transformed into one that's rooted in financialization. And that means that a lot of the companies and producers and brand names are now financial companies, primarily just doing the main engineering of a product, the technological development, but they never produce any of it. And in fact, much of the money that goes into paying for it and so forth with respect to building factories, and paying for wages, comes through a financialization process. And by that, I mean that the workers are in almost every case not directly employed by multinational corporations, but they're employed by contractors and subcontractors, often in very difficult and arduous conditions. And so all this process of trade liberalization is rooted in the concept that the costs flow to the lowest cost producer. It's almost a law of physics. When we think of physics, we know very clearly that water flows to the lowest level, and in the same way, we can say that capital gets invested where labor costs are the lowest and where profits are the highest. With respect to the question of imperialism, we've found that, and I think this is extremely correct, that capitalist investment does follow a pattern that takes the form of the old imperialist countries, but also the contemporary forms of imperialism that exist. And in this way, we may also often say, well, the United States is going to get jobs back. They just have to make sure their working class gets lower wages. And yes, there is a degree to which that's true. But whenever we hear these stories about we need to get our jobs back and so forth, it's so sad to say those jobs are never going to come back because there's no way American workers or European workers are going to get paid $1 or $2 an hour, and sometimes even less if they're competing with Chinese workers and Indian workers and so forth and so on. And so in this sense, I would say that, David Harvey uses his term with respect to imperialism as a molecular process of financial transactions that go from one financial market to the other, and wherever the lowest cost can be found, that's where capital invests. But I would agree with him and make a further point that I think is crucial, and that is there's a tendency or a propensity for those investments to take place in the poorest countries. They don't flow back necessarily to France, Canada, United States. They go to the poorest countries, ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, give us some numbers real briefly to back up your claim that the working class hasn't disappeared, it's just moved.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two very important things to remember, that the working class in the United States also hasn't disappeared. It also has, obviously moved to different regions where there are lower wages here in this country, but they've declined relatively as the population has grown. And so there's still an auto sector in the United States. There's still a large aerospace industry, pharmaceutical production, agribusiness, and so forth. Those are the major exporters, not to mention the aerospace military industrial complex.
You're talking about industrial working class, right?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, okay.
I am. But commodified workers who work for a wage and don't live on the farm and make grow their own things, basically. But yes, industrial. With respect to industrial workforce, the United States still has one, but I would say, all you have to do is look at the numbers, which are derived from the International Labor Organization, as well as the World Bank and other multilateral organizations, and you'll find that actually the working class, industrial working class that makes cars, electronics, clothing, and so forth, has grown dramatically. And so, for instance, at the apogee in the United States, we may have had, 30, 40, 50 million industrial workers. Today, that's far less. But in the world as a whole, we have more industrial workers than at any time in the history of capitalism. Mm. Somewhere near 800 to 900 million workers, almost a billion workers on the planet, are making industrial goods for export mainly. And so this creates a huge surplus of goods that allows many consumers around the world to pay extremely low wages for cars and other products, but low prices for cars and other products. But even more importantly, the capitalists make super profits on the basis of what I would call super exploitation of workers. Uh-huh. So that we do have a very large working class. They work in places that are not only low wage, but they work in the most decrepit, dangerous, polluted environments where children work side by side their parents. For instance, the disaster of Rana Plaza, where some 1,000 plus women and their children perished in the collapse of the building in mm-hmm. Dhaka, Bangladesh. That's real. I mean, those things happen on a very, everyday basis. So nothing is, as you know, perhaps as well known as Rana in recent years, but they, you have many cases of that on a regular basis. People are exposed to, for instance, the occupational safety issues related to producing cell phones when benzene batteries are produced that are very dangerous for the workers. They can destroy kidneys and other organs of the body.
Mm-hmm.
And so people died earlier ages in places like China, India, and other poor countries. I say poor countries because the workers get paid extremely low wages, not necessarily because they're only, not necessarily because they're, there's no ruling class that's making lots of money, but the workers as a whole are relatively poor compared to us in the United States and Canada.
Mm-hmm. So the heart of the book is three case studies, one from India, one from China, and one from South Africa, about how workers are organizing. They certainly haven't given up given these horrible conditions. They are organizing in really exciting new ways, in ways that are different from how unions in the global north, in the U.S., Europe, Canada, have organized. Can you give us some examples?
Yes. You know, the working class in India, which is amongst the largest, second largest in the world to China, is an industrial working class, and it's becoming proletarianized, or, you know, as many others would argue, it's a precarious working class. They're recently off the rural areas, forced off the land into the urban production centers, and 92% of that workforce, remember there was 150 million people who went on strike, 150 million workers who went on strike last month, 92% of that, the general workforce in India, are employed as contract workers. Which means that 8% of the workforce are working full-time. And that represents a tremendous disparity, obviously, within a country that such a great degree of the workforce doesn't have any job security. Contract workers get paid, I will say, one-tenth the wages of full-time workers. They don't even reach the level of minimum wage. They're not protected by the same laws. They're exposed to far greater hazards. They tend to be women in many instances, by a large measure. And one thing that I make clear in this book, a lot of the workers, industrial workers are women workers. And, I definitely think, so in this case, we can look at the double aspect, the double bind. On the one hand, you have women who have to take care of their families in patriarchal systems. Yet on the other, they're also working, putting together computers, building cars, working in shipyards and so forth. This is actually the workforce of the Global South. They're, much mm-hmm. more diverse, and, obviously there are regional differences, but, for instance, in a place like China, the most skilled workers are working-class workers are women, electronics workers.
So how are they organizing that's new and different?
Good question. Well, they're organizing. This is what I've seen in my work, is that workers always organize around issues related to injustice. But this is something, as an organizer myself, I've seen that it isn't really all that hard to organize workers to demand higher wages, to demand back payment of wages, to demand better working conditions and safe working conditions and lower hours and benefits. That's something that happens on an everyday basis. But the ways they're organizing these days is because it is on their own through creating assemblies of workers, through building committees on the shop floor or in the mines or in the cafeterias and dormitories where a lot of workers work, say, in China. And so they're building these alliances built on solidarity, socialization, and so forth. And yet, at the same time, they don't really have agency to represent those demands. So what we're seeing is two things. One is the rise of new unions that are competing for a membership on the basis of their capacity to be honest and deliver and make higher demands, because a lot of the unions that emerged in the 80s and 90s, Beverly Silver, in her work, does a really good job, Forces of Labor, that those agreements that were based on corporate agreements, even collective bargaining agreements, they're not really working anymore because of the capacity for corporations to always go to lower-priced workers. But in some cases, let's say the the platinum line workers of South Africa would be perhaps the best example, where there's really no other workers besides the platinum mines, because they're the ones that are skilled and they're there. They formed major assemblies to contest the really terrible contracts they received from their National Union of Mine Workers, which they were members of, and they challenged that union to come up with better wages and so forth. And there was a massacre that took place on August 16th, 2012, 4 years ago. And the workers formed their own assemblies where they camped out on the hillocks of the mining region. And as it happened, a new union came along and said, you know, we'll represent your interests economically and in every other way we can. And they went on strike for about 5 months, from January to May-June of 2014. And the strike was for demanding the equivalent of, let's say, $1,000 a month. And they were making $300 a month to begin with. And, you know, they made that. They actually made they ended up making about $800 a month, $800 or $900. You know, so in other words, they more than doubled their wages on the basis of this 5-6 month strike, which, of course, is painful to the workers. Mm-hmm. And so that's, we can't deny that. But here is an example of 70,000 to 80,000 workers in the most important industry of South Africa going on strike in a country that has not yet redistributed the income from whites and the wealth from whites to blacks, South Africans. And here's a very important case where mine workers are almost all black South Africans fighting for a share of the national wealth that is controlled by mainly multinationals and primarily benefits the white population
right
there.
Well, we're sure almost out of time, Manny. But, you know, one of the things that comes through loud and clear is that these workers have not only often been abandoned by their traditional unions, but sometimes they're not even allowed to organize because they're contract workers, and they've been abandoned by their own governments. But I want to ask you one last question,
yeah,
and you're going to have to make it quick. You know, your perspective on the global economy is really quite different from what I think people ordinarily hear talked about, particularly in our presidential campaign. I assume you disagree with the perspective of both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton on globalization. Can you comment at all on what they get either right or wrong?
Sure. And I've said this publicly. You know, Donald Trump has gotten everything wrong. We're not losing jobs to Chinese. In fact, we're probably getting jobs. The argument is that, yes, we may be losing manufacturing jobs that we're not going to do anymore. I hate this. I think I don't hate to say he's wrong, but I hate to say that these jobs are not coming back. And that might be a good thing. Do we want polluted cities where industrial, you know, steel is made? That creates
a lot
of
pollution. No, but we want decent living wage jobs, right?
Yes,
What about Hillary?
I mean, a lot of those jobs come back as service jobs. With respect to Hillary, you know, she's promoting some of the worst trade deals in the world, TPP being one example of that, and I don't think I'm too much different from others. And on that basis, she has contributed to the erosion of decent jobs here in the United States and elsewhere. So to a large extent, she's making a power play that she did with her husband, if you want to call them a team, she does, in NAFTA that was so debilitating. And then again, with the pushing toward the World Trade Organization. And if she does support the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this has nothing but, you know, really bad news for American workers, because the jobs remain, and those industrial jobs are decent, are going to all disappear. So,
of
you
course,
know, maybe the best jobs, the aerospace jobs.
Of course, she says she's opposed to it. We will see.
Yeah, no.
We've been talking to Manny Ness, Emmanuel Ness. His new book is called Southern Insurgency, The Coming of the Global Working Class by Pluto Press. It's really packed with important information. Thank you so much, Manny.
Thank you. Can I just say one quick thing?
Yeah.
I think I want to add something about spontaneity and the necessity to build organization, but maybe for another time.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let's talk about it and see what we can do. Thanks a lot.
Take
Bye-bye.
Care. Thanks to your listeners.
Okay. I neglected to mention at the beginning of the show that this is Pledge Week. And This is the time you can show your support for KKFI and the Heartland Labor Forum by calling 888-931-0901. Where else do you get interviews like that? And sitting in the studio with me is Christina Hendricks and Shaikalyn Hams. Hi, girls. What do you have to say about KKFI?
Okay. Well, first of all, I want this radio to stay on the air. I believe in the mission of KKFI, and I believe it's different from anything else that's out there. I want KKFI to keep on bringing you stuff that cannot be heard anywhere.
And personally for me, I recently joined KKFI. It's been an excellent opportunity to connect with my community and also to become more informed. Without this program, I feel like I wouldn't really been able to connect with the Kansas City community and the radio community like I have. So definitely please call at 888-931-0901.
And you can pledge online at kkfi.org. And we have some premiums. If you would like a KKFI t-shirt with a really funny cartoon on it for $90 or more, you can get that t-shirt. Just tell the person who answers. And of course, if you want to feed your hidden DJ, you can get a guest DJ on one of our music programs for $150, and that's an hour of spinning your favorite tunes. So pledge to the Heartland Labor Forum, pledge to KKFI. I know I'm going to go right out there and pledge, and I hope you do too. We're putting our money where our mouth is. Please help us, 888-931-0901.
Good evening. Hi, I am Christina Hendricks.
And I'm Barbara Wright.
You're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum on KKFI. Joining me this evening is author and community leader Chiluba Musonda. Chiluba traveled from Zambia to Kansas City to study at UMKC. Now he is executive director at Bruce Walkins Cultural Heritage Center and Museum. He is also the author of his book, Home Away from Home. Tonight, he'll be talking to us about the struggle and rewards of making in Kansas City. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, first off, I'd like to jump on in. How did you choose to come to the United States?
You know, it's a crazy story. The credit has to go to my mother. She was an international student back in the 1980s, and she had this vision and dream to send her kids to study abroad. My older sister was fortunate enough to go to Russia, and when it came to my turn to pick a location, I chose the United States because I had this dream of ending up in Hollywood. It hasn't quite worked out like that, but here I am with you all. So it was really my mother's dream to get me to study abroad.
Oh, perfect. And how long have you been here?
I've been in Kansas City for about 13 years, and how I ended up in Kansas City is pretty amazing as well. I applied to four random colleges around the United States, had no idea where I was going, and the University of Missouri, Kansas City was the first to respond with a full admission packet, with a full response to my application, and I ended up here in Kansas City, and I've stayed ever since.
And just looking at your application process to here, what opportunities are there for youths in Zambia?
You know, it's a mixed bag. When you look at the unemployment rate in Zambia, it's about 15%. 1 in 5 individuals, majority of which are young, are unemployed. Opportunities are very, very limited. When I was growing up in Zambia, there were 2 universities in the entire country, and that's not enough for the population that was there. There are more universities and more colleges now, but when I was there, educational opportunities, work opportunities were not there, which is why my mother wanted myself and my older sister to study abroad, and I was fortunate enough to leave the country, so very, very limited opportunities.
Absolutely, and after explaining that, so that makes me ask, in your opinion, so when you're looking, coming to the United States, applying for these colleges, and eventually ending up at UMKC, but what do you think are the United States' greatest strengths and weaknesses when it comes to finding work here?
Sure. So right now, with the current statistics, there are over 1.1 million international students in this country. 400,000 of that 1.1 million are here to pursue studies in the STEM fields, which is sciences, technology, engineering, and math. The craziest thing about it is international students are limited to work on campus, at the campus where they are studying or pursuing their studies. And unfortunately, most campuses just don't have a lot of jobs. So most international students are locked to just paying attention to their academics. I was fortunate enough to find a job within 2 months of getting here. I recall working at the UMKC bookstore, making minimum wage. And I'm one of those people who is a big proponent of the minimum wage, because in Zambia, when I grew up, there was no minimum wage. And the level of abuse and the level of disrespect that labor gets in Zambia without a minimum wage is pretty crazy. So when I think of my experience here in the United States, I know there are a lot of folks who are against the minimum wage or would like to see it increased. For me, it was a big, big benefit just to get a job to begin with, given my background from Zambia. So most international students do struggle to find work. The culture is an issue, the language is an issue, and then the opportunities are limited. So it's quite the challenge for a lot of these students.
So even after graduating from UMKC, even if you were to go back to Zambia, would it still be hard for you to find a job even with that level of education?
I think, you know, the United States is respected around the world when it comes to higher education. So folks who come and study here at the United States do have an advantage when they go back home, because people at home respect the institutions that are here. So it is advantageous for folks to come and study abroad if they can afford it. But one thing I didn't mention is the cost of studying in the United States as an international student is pretty steep. International students pay anywhere between 3 to 5 times more than the average domestic student does. So not only are we talking about challenges for these students to find employment, just the cost itself. I was fortunate enough to have access to scholarships. I was fortunate enough to have people who surrounded me and were willing to help me and give me a hand up, but it's quite a challenge.
But it seems like the pros have outweighed the cons, even though it's been that challenge. So far, that challenge has been worth it. What steps did you take after graduating to find a solid job here in the United States? What challenges did you find? Was it challenging, or were the resources already set in place here?
I think it's a combination of both. In my case, I was fortunate enough to find employers who are willing and committed to hiring folks from diverse backgrounds. So I think my background on top of my educational experience helped me significantly. When I left UMKC after my first degree, I worked for the Healthcare Foundation of Greater Kansas City, a wonderful organization that does great work in the city. They're committed to diversity, and I was able to get a job there. I'm not saying diversity is what got me the job, but they're committed to embracing people from different walks of life. And it's the same experience I have now as a city employee. The city is a wonderful place to work. You have people from all walks of life. They're committed to that, too. So to me, one of the biggest pros, or one of the things that helped me, was a lot of institutions care about the racial and national makeup of their staff. And I think everyone just benefits from that. I certainly did.
Well, I kind of like to go back to your school. A lot of people, a lot of Americans think that you, Chalupa, and other foreign students get all of these handouts. You get extra things that they just don't get. And you've already told us that your tuition is much higher than others. What supports do you get while you are here and in school to help you maintain while you're there?
Sure, that's a great question. I can speak to my experience at UMKC. One of the wonderful things UMKC has is an International Student Affairs Office, an office dedicated to recruit and retain international students. When I came into the country 13 years ago, I went through a rigorous orientation program where I was allowed to understand the things I would have to expect in the U.S. classroom, where I could find a job, learn about the different customs and cultures. So there were so many services that I was able to take advantage of. But let's make no mistake, those services do not outweigh or do not pin down the domestic student. These are separate services that target international students. So that myth of international students coming here and taking jobs is simply not true, and which is why I published a book. I wanted to break those barriers. I wanted to get people more exposed to what life is really like for an international student. Now, I will say on the flip side of that, do more international students end up taking jobs that are tied to sciences, technology, engineering, and math? Absolutely. Like I mentioned earlier, of 1.1 million international students, 400,000 of them are studying or pursuing fields in sciences. They're the ones who are going to end up taking those jobs. But I think that's a question as Americans. Americans have to decide, are we spending enough resources on ensuring that our children, that American children, are pursuing sciences as well? Because if not, the major corporations, they have to hire somebody. They have to fill those jobs, and international students are an easy recruiting pool. So I think that myth exists, but we need to break that down a little bit further.
And so you were talking about your book and sort of the impact that you want to make. Were there any other goals maybe you met or didn't meet, or goals and intentions in this book? And how well do you feel that you met those goals?
Well, I wrote this book primarily for three reasons. Reason number one, it was meant to be a vivid report card for my mother. She spent a lot of money, spent a lot of resources in getting me here. So this was my way of thanking her and reporting to her of what I had been through in Kansas City. The second reason was to close the information gap that exists. I can't tell you how many times when I first came to Kansas City, people would ask me the craziest questions. Are you from a village? Where did you learn how to speak English? Are there any roads in Africa? Where did you get your clothes from? So the book answers those questions. And then the third and final reason was to educate people back at home, specifically in Zambia. When I first came here, my friends thought I was in Hollywood, hanging out with Taylor Swift and Beyonce. Now, I'm hanging out with you wonderful ladies tonight, you are no Beyonce and you are no Taylor Swift. But I had to address those issues. There is more to America than Hollywood. But that stereotype exists back in Africa. So those were my three reasons for publishing this book. And I feel I've accomplished some of those goals, at least. As long as my mother is proud, I'm a happy camper.
And so could you expand on us, now that you have this book out, now you feel like you've met your goal, what projects are you working on at the present?
Right now, it's still about spreading the word. I give presentations throughout the year about Africa. My goal is to open the world up to Africa. Are there problems? Is there widespread poverty on the continent of Africa? Absolutely. But there's another side. So I spend my free time as much as I can trying to talk to young people about the continent of Africa, trying to encourage people to go to Africa, certain places that are safe for tourism purposes. So that's what I work on outside of work. But most of the time I'm busy at the Bruce R. Watkins Cultural Heritage Center trying to promote African American history. But those are the things I'm working on right now.
Well, I love your book, Home Away From Home, and your website. Can you give us your website? Because it is chock full of wonderful information. One of your articles that I read was really amazing. So what is your website?
Absolutely. My website is www.chiluba.com. I'll spell that out. That's chiluba.com. I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, but if people need my information, they could also go on Google and just Google Home Away From Home, story about an international student.
Okay, awesome. I just want to make sure that people can find your book if they want. But there's another question that I would like to ask you, going back to the students And that is, when you come over from another country, I had kind of talked to you previously, and you had said that you love the United States and you want to be a citizen, and I could hear the excitement. And sometimes we, you know, we talk about America and its problems, and you talk about wanting to be a citizen. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the, maybe the pros and cons about coming here and then maybe having to go back home, or why you would want to stay here?
Sure. We'll start with the positives.
Okay.
I sincerely believe I would not have achieved what I have achieved had I not come to the United States. I mean, let's stop and think. 14 years ago, I was hanging out on street corners in Africa, had no idea what my future was going to be like. Now, you know, 14 years later, here I am on KKFI radio talking to you all. I'm a published author. I serve as an executive director at one of Kansas City's landmark facilities. So it's quite an honor. America has that ability to make people's dreams come true. So that's the biggest pro. On the cons, missing my family, being so far away from home, I can't tell you how many anniversaries, birthdays, even funerals that I've missed out on. So it's pretty, being far away from home is quite a challenge. But I will tell you one thing that has disappointed me the most is I would have thought America would have made more progress when it comes to race relations. Back in Africa, I thought we were on an even playing field, and I have come to learn otherwise. So that's one of the things that I'm still working through.
Well, as a few last moments wrapping up, either can you tell us like what your plans for our future projects include, or maybe tell us, are there any last words that you'd like to tell our audience or what you would like them to remember?
Well, future projects, I intend to write a book in the near future, maybe something on leadership, maybe a fictional story. But what I want people to take away from this conversation, and most importantly from my book, is I want to open the world up to Africa. I want to open the world up to Zambia. Africa is progressing. There are countries that are showing good signs of economic progress. And I'm one of those people who believes we need to move away from foreign aid and promote trade. So from aid to trade. So my hope is that people understand that there's a lot of progress being made in Africa. Nothing's perfect. Not everything's perfect, but there's a lot of work that can be done. And for those that care, they could check out my book. Again, that's Home Away From Home, the story of an international student's journey from Africa to America.
Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And for our listeners, that was Chiluba Musonda talking about his book, A Home Away From Home. My name is Christina Hendricks.
And I'm Barbara Wright.
All right. Thank you very much.
Working at this job is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. Oh, if I had the time and the proper equipment, I could do my job safely each day. Everybody here says they're sticklers for safety, and I'm not here to say that they lie. I'm saying we just come to work here. We don't come to die.
Hello, this is Mary Ario for Safety First. First, lead exposure beyond Flint from www.environmentalhealthnews.org for September 12th. Rachel Schaefer and Stephen Gilbert from the School of Public Health at the University of Washington, Seattle have published a convincing commentary on the need to update U.S. standards on lead exposure in the workplace. Lead poisoning returned to national consciousness this year through the tragic events in Flint, Michigan, but drinking water is only one of many exposure routes. Because of outdated federal workplace safety standards, acute and chronic occupational lead exposure occurs all too often and can harm workers and their children, who may be exposed prenatally or through lead dust carried into the home. The U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, regulates workplace lead exposure at the national level through two standards, the General Industry and Construction Industry Standard. Both of these standards are severely outdated based on information available in the 1970s instead of the latest scientific and medical evidence. Exposures to levels of lead much lower than what is allowable under OSHA's current standards have been linked to high blood pressure, decreased kidney function, reproductive effects, and neurological impairments. In industries with high potential for lead exposure, such as construction, gun ranges, and battery reclaiming and manufacturing, not only are workers at risk, but their families may also be exposed inadvertently through take-home lead dust. Read the entire commentary at www.environmentalhealthnews.org for September 12th. Finally, does Dollar General ignore safety inspectors? From EHSToday.com for September 7th. Discount retailer Dollar General continues to ignore federal workplace safety inspectors who have previously have warned the company to correct hazards that could potentially jeopardize customer and employee safety during an emergency. OSHA recently responded to a complaint and investigated the company's Van Buren, Missouri location, once again finding blocked exits and other hazards. A serious violation was given after inspectors found the stockroom provided little access to exit areas in the event of an emergency because merchandise and materials restricted exit routes. In addition, throughout the store, numerous rolltainers, push carts, and customer carts full of merchandise were found in aisleways blocking emergency egress. Inspectors found one repeat and one serious safety citation for a total of $98,000 in proposed fines. Dollar General's previous citations date back to 2010. The company, which operates in more than 12,000 stores in 43 states and employs 100,000 workers, has been cited more than 100 times for various safety and health issues. One likely reason, according to an article on the booming dollar store economy from www.huffingtonpost.com, August 29, 2013, the hours that dollar store managers are allowed to assign rarely cover the work that needs to be done. The stores operate on something close to a skeleton staff, workers say. Thanks for listening to Safety First. This is Mary Ario.
All right, and here we are, asking you for money again. I'm with Barbara Wright and Christina Hendricks, and this is the Heartline Labor Forum. I'm Judy Ansel, and we need you to call 888-931-0901. And why is that?
Well, first off, KKFI has been an excellent opportunity, especially for someone who's been new to Kansas City. I just joined not too long ago, and it gives you definitely access to a different framework of Kansas City that you don't really see when you first come. So without KKFI, I don't really think I get the full experience of Kansas City and its community than I would have without.
How about you, Barbara?
Yes, and I've spoken with so many people who love the music on KKFI and the informational shows. And the Heartland Labor Forum being one of the only shows from miles around that focuses on the workers in the workplace and the labor unions. And there's only a few voices out there still speaking for you. So you definitely need to call that number so that you can keep this great radio station on the air. It is a community radio station that is publicly supported. We need you.
Right, because we don't have any advertising. We're independent. And in the age of corporate media, to have independent media is something that really needs to be preserved in this country. It's so tied in with our democracy. Speaking of which, the Heartland Labor Forum has been covering the elections. And, you know, you don't get this on the mainstream media, but we talk about, you know, what the candidates' positions are about workers and labor rights and trade and just like the guest we had, who had a totally different perspective on the candidates than we've even had on this show. We try to mix it up and we try to give you the information you need in order to make an intelligent decision in the elections.
Things you may miss during the general debates.
Right, right.
The other excellent thing about this radio station is that you can go to the website. The website is beautiful. Looking at the website, you might think it's not community radio, but it is one of the most well-organized sites I've seen. You can listen to it from anywhere in the world. It is the most awesome website. And if you listen to a great show, usually you can go back the next day and listen again. So you definitely want to be supporting KKFI. You definitely want to support this radio station. It's one of the best I've ever seen.
And that number is
888-931-0901.
It's real simple. All you have to do is pick up the phone and call us and make a pledge. We don't care how much. Well, we do, but you know, even if it's small, we'll certainly be happy for it. And show your support for the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. And now I think it's time for the calendar, Jen.
Hello. Okay, so here's what we have. A march on the presidential debate in St. Louis. That is Sunday, October 9th. Buses leave at 8 a.m. and 11 a.m. and return that evening. You can RSVP to info@standupkc.org. Then, Greater Kansas City AFL-CIO monthly meeting is Tuesday, October 11th at 5:30 at the Argosy Casino. Reina Grande, author of Memoir of Immigration and Activist. She is speaking Thursday, October 16th at 6 p.m. at UMKC Pearson Hall. It is 50th and Rock Hill in KCMO. Martin Fernandez, Human Rights Crisis in Honduras. He is giving a speech Friday at October 14th at 10 a.m. at UMKC in Katz Hall, 50th and Rock Hill, the southeast corner. And lastly, Leon Jordan talks about the rise of Black politics in Kansas City, October 24th at 5:30 p.m. at the UMKC Miller-Nichols Learning Center, Jeanette Nichols Forum, 51st and Holmes. And you can RSVP to leonjordankc.eventbrite.com. And you can check us out on the web at heartlandlaborforum.org.
Thanks, Jen. And tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show will be The KC Rent Bubble and Citizens for Community Benefits Agreements. Thanks to our engineer, Jen Zaman. It's going to be special. You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.